Don't beat yourself up in your own area, but rather get involved, go out, engage with others, and find better ways of doing something, whatever you're doing, more sustainably. That's more fun, and it tends to be more effective. There are many measures that need to be implemented. They need to be coordinated with each other in the sense of the integrated policies. The positive message is, if done well, we can increase human well-being and reduce social inequality on the way. This is why we're talking about a socio-ecological transformation.
Inside Impact.
Der Podcast mit Wirkung. Hello and welcome back to Inside Impact, and welcome to our series Sustainability Meets Social Entrepreneurship. My name is Martin.
And I am Susan. Welcome back to a new episode of Inside Impact, also from my side. And for those of you who are new here, the current episode is part of a podcast cooperation of the Social Entrepreneurship Center and the Competence Center for Sustainability, Transformation and Responsibility here at VU Vienna.
Exactly. And today we are providing you with a deep dive into the topic of sustainability.
Sigrid Stagel is professor and head of the Department of Socioeconomics and founder of the Institute of Ecological Economics at VU Vienna. Her research interests are sustainable work and ecological macroeconomics, among others.
Being the first person globally who completed a PhD program in ecological economics, she will introduce us to the term sustainability from an academic standpoint today. Among others, she will touch on the topics what do we mean when talking about sustainability and what is the current state of the art in research.
Have fun!
Hello, Sigrid. Thanks for being here with us today. So how are you today?
Hello. Thanks for the invitation. I'm very well. Thank you. Healthy, and that's the most important during this period.
Yes, for sure. That's great to hear. Can you give us a quick introduction to you and to your work as a VU professor and researcher?
Sure. My name is Sigrid Stagel. I'm a professor of environmental economics and policy at the Vienna University of Economics and Business. At the moment, I'm head of the Department of Socioeconomics, I founded the Institute for Ecological Economics. So that indicates already it's sort of, I'm an economist, but I'm concerned about the societal context within the economy is embedded in, and the two of them, the economy and society, are embedded in the biophysical context. So really, when studying the economy, we need to account for, have on the radar, society as well as the biophysical basis of economic production, as well as the nearer firm household-state interactions. In my research, I have mostly worked on in the sectors of energy and food, and I've worked on ecological macroeconomics, sustainable human behavior, as well as integrated.
Thank you. I think we will touch upon some of the topics where you are very knowledgeable in. So as this is the very first episode of our new podcast series on the intersection between social entrepreneurship and sustainability, I wanted to ask you to give us the most prominently used definition of sustainability that we hear in the discourse around sustainability.
Well, the most famous one is, of course, of 1987 from the Brundtland Report. It says that the goal of sustainability is to meet the needs of the current generation without compromising the needs of future generations. And this is a useful definition. Of course, it indicates that it's an anthropocentric definition. So it's all about human needs. Yeah? I might want to add also about ecosystem integrity and maybe also about ecosystem health as additional dimensions, although, of course, they also have effects on human needs per se. But maybe we shouldn't look at the environment only as something that gives us an opportunity to meet our needs, but also it might have rights in itself, but that would be a bigger discussion of sort of our philosophical underpinning. What I find also useful as a definition for sustainability is to have an economic system that is regenerative. in the sense that it uses its resources, all elements, and that includes humans, in a way that it doesn't overuse any of it. In the sense of when we are using energy services, we are using renewable services. When we're using materials, we are using them in such a way that we keep them in the loop. We have a circular economy. And when we are, when humans are offering services to the economy, it is done in a way that they're not excessively stressed, pushed into situations that are really difficult for them, but rather it's they also have opportunities to regenerate, also be part of their community. Communities have an opportunity to flourish. So all of that for me is also part of a regenerative economy, which I think might add to the other definition of meeting the needs. Because what's widely used is this definition of the three pillars of sustainability, the economic, the social, and the environmental. And I think it's useful to highlight that for being successful, we need to have multiple dimensions on the radar at the same time and really account for them and include them in our decision making. So that is useful. However, to depict it as pillars, I mean, if we imagine pillars in a building, they must be separate from each other. And this is really not helpful. Because if we think about the issues that we are dealing with, it's very difficult to identify any dimension that is not related to others. Yeah. So this is what I don't find useful in terms of a definition of sustainability to depict it as pillars, but rather put it as dimensions. And then it's very clear that we're talking about one system, the economy embedded in society and the two of them embedded in the biophysical context. And then it's very clear that there are overlaps, there are interdependencies. There may be win-win situations that we can identify, but there may be also conflicts. And it's exactly at these interfaces that the most interesting questions actually arise, and we shouldn't separate them out artificially.
That's a very valid point. And when we are talking about those intersections between different areas of concern, what would you say, this is maybe a very difficult question, but what would you say is the most interesting, captive, but also pressuring intersection between different dimensions that we perceive in, for example, today's situation, corona crisis?
I think what the corona crisis has highlighted, the multiple dimension it has highlighted, on the one hand, how unprepared we were for a crisis of that nature. Also, zoonotic diseases are actually endogenous of our economic system as we are encroaching more and more into ecosystems. So it's not surprising, actually, that viruses jump over to humans. So this threat has been underestimated, and very few put us on alarm for that, although it was an imminent threat. So that is one. We were unprepared. The other one is, in addition to efficiency, distribution of income and wealth, in addition to biophysical boundaries, also resilience is an important concept. But the third one, and that may be the most interesting one, at least for me from a conceptual perspective, is that it has highlighted the interlinkages between, for example, health and the environment, health and employment, and so on. So this indicates that there are always, if we have one policy that, for example, an economic policy that one is pursuing, it has repercussions, it has impact on other dimensions. And to aim for harvesting the synergistic effects of that, the double dividends, the triple dividends, the positive co-benefits, as well as being aware of negative effects on other dimensions. This is something that is under-researched, and also policymakers don't have it as much on their radar as they should because, well, we have the Ministry of Economic Affairs, then we have the Ministry of Social Affairs, we have the Ministry of Climate and the Environment, and so on. So again, these are pillars which, of course, have an impact on how policies are formulated. So I think what we need in going forward is more integrated policies, policy proposals that on the one hand are aware of co-benefits, but also costs to other dimensions, and harvest double dividends, triple dividends much more systematically, because this is not just a more effective, but also a cheaper way of undertaking policies. One example would be it has been documented that a lot of climate policies have positive effects on employment. by using more local resources, for example, or using more regenerative resources or energy services. If done well, this can have positive employment effects. Also, climate policies have positive effects on local health. And so on. To be aware of the multiple dimensions of policies and then aiming for integrated policies, I think this is something that on the one hand should have been on the radar for much longer, but the coronavirus has highlighted it again, that there is no such thing as a one-dimensional policy that we can pursue, but it always has repercussions.
On the one side, I would really like to hear your perspective on the Austrian situation, because I think as you are active and as a researcher in Austria, you might have a very insightful news and information for our audience as well on how well is Austria doing in climate policies on one side, but also how maybe the business sector is actually changing, transforming towards more sustainable business methods, and how in general the ecological situation or socio-ecological situation is developing. And on the other side, I would also look very much into the personal individual aspects of what you already also touched upon, which is the behavioral aspects of change. But this, maybe we can first look at Austria and then maybe go into that a bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me start with businesses, because this is an important topic in the Competence Center as well as in the social innovations community. Well, climate science had a consensus that there is something badly going wrong with economic production and the impacts on the environment for 50 years. There was a consensus in climate economics for 40 years that there are ways of addressing this, and actually economic incentives are put wrongly and they need to be corrected. We've had 30 years of climate rhetoric, important politicians, international leaders acknowledging the problem and saying we need to do something. Business as usual is no longer on. Hopefully now, very soon, we are getting climate action, and this is necessary. So it was a long way. It was a tedious way. It was also an opportunity to check and recheck the science and making sure that this is really what we are observing, and we are not putting extra cost on the economy unnecessarily. Yeah? It has been checked. It has been rechecked. It has been rechecked. So we are certain about it that climate action is necessary. My assessment is that in the broader population, of course, the levels of knowledge are very different, but most people, and this goes really across the socioeconomic strata, have a hunch, have an impression, have a clear feeling about it that there is something that's not quite right. If you can fly for 19 euros to Barcelona, it doesn't sound like this is correct. Yeah, but there's a difference between, on the one hand, as a citizen, we perceive that there's something wrong, while as consumers, if we're given that opportunity, then of course we jump on that bandwagon. Yeah, so this is not to blame anybody. It's just we need different rules for the economy so that these obvious breaches of true costs accounting are no longer possible. Yeah, so that's one aspect. So that's in the broader population. I think there is an acknowledgement, but what we don't have yet is a systematic assurance that more sustainable behaviors are possible, so that everybody has an opportunity to choose between a high carbon and a low carbon lifestyle. Yeah, that depends very much on where you live, under what circumstances you live, and this needs to be changed. Yeah, because once everybody has a choice, then the prices don't bite so badly. Because if I can't choose a low carbon lifestyle, but the high carbon lifestyle is expensive, well, I may want to choose the low carbon one. Yeah, but if I'm stuck in a situation where I don't have a choice, that is really problematic. The companies, of course, we need to differentiate. Some companies are in business because they want to produce sustainably. They are currently, with the current economic regulations, being held back in their development. Yeah, so that's actually really unfair towards them. And we all have ideas about very nice producers who are really treating their workers well and only using a regenerative natural resource base. We all have ideas of them and may want to buy from them. But they are held back in a niche because it's only for those consumers who are willing to pay extra for that regenerative way of producing. And that's not right, because they shouldn't be at a disadvantage. Then there is another group of companies who will need to transition. They will need to change what they're offering, for example, consultants. In previous times, they were consulting to make sure that the highest shareholder value is secured. Of course, they brought in the idea of stakeholder value. And over time, of course, by now, they are fully geared up with ESGs and impact investing and so on. And they're just changing their services. Yeah? So no bigger effect there. And they tend to be pioneers because they want to sell their new services. And then in the producing sector, we have companies that are also leading the way in the sense they know that there is change on the horizon, and therefore they have already innovated, and they want to get a level playing field compared to their competitors. So they welcome climate regulation and don't have any problem with more stringent environmental regulation. Okay. And then there are laggards. Then there are companies who either find it really difficult because their core business is unsustainable, or they don't tend to be the innovative sections of their respective industry. And if they haven't understood by now that change is on the horizon, I think it's just they'll wait for the regulation to come in. But then it might be more expensive for them because it's always better if you anticipate when change is about to come and make the decisions in good time. Yeah. So this is how I think that it's not a question of is more stringent climate regulation good for the economy. We can't say that because it's so differentiated. Then maybe about government. Austria has for a while, maybe 20, 30 years, pride in saying that Austria is sort of a leader in an environmental policy. And this may not be when it comes to freshwater quality assurance. And also in terms of recycling, we've been doing quite well. Yeah. But there are many other dimensions, to be honest, where we are not an environmental policy leader. For example, in using up land, sealing land, or giving subsidies to unsustainable production or unsustainable practices. Yeah. And unfortunately, also in the area of climate policy, Austria has really been a laggard. When you compare how different companies, for example, in the European Union have been able to reduce their emissions, Austria is really amongst the poorest achievers there. For example, Denmark, since 1990, has reduced their emissions by, I think, 34%. On average, the EU has reduced their emissions by 20%. Austria has stabilized the emissions. Of course, now this is meant to be changed. Yeah? The new governments, I mean, it's still new because they haven't been able to get into gears, really, because they were held back a bit with the corona crisis. But the current government agreement says, of course, that they're planning to make Austria climate neutral, at least in net terms, by 2040. And this is right. As we have heard from the German Constitutional Court, the goal of having decarbonization or climate neutralization by 2050 was considered as not enough, but rather putting too much burden on future generations, on the young people, and limiting the freedom of young people. So the German government needs to improve their current climate law. Fortunately, the Austrian government has been more stringent, has been more forthcoming, already in putting the 2040 goal into the government agreement. But of course, now it's necessary to follow through with that. And 2040 is also a long way away, so it's important. What is the Austrian government doing by 2030? Well, there it will get a target, a goal from the European Union, because the European Parliament has, of course, agreed a reduction of 55% by 2030, which is 8.5 years. It's only 8.5 years. And the European Union has committed to reduce its emission by 55%. Yeah? So on the one hand, how to do that? Yeah, what is the plan to achieve that? I mean, this is really steep. On the other hand, we have lots of low-hanging fruits, but just changing the economic incentives slightly will tip over a lot of behaviors, a lot of production techniques that have been only waiting for a stronger incentive. But on the other hand, we also need shorter-term targets still, because 2030 for many governments is a long way away. Who knows who is in power then? So I think we also need targets for 2025 to be put in place and to make them also legally binding, so that also the earnest desire becomes very clear. So these are the next steps. On the one hand, to make the goals more precise. To some degree, we have seen that already, but also make them more short-term and then put them in law. And that's the way forward.
One short question, because you mentioned those low-hanging fruits that in Austria could be achieved or earned, harvested. Could you give some examples of what this specifically could be? Or what those low-hanging fruits are?
Yeah, I'll mention three from three different sectors. And this is in addition to industry action, because this is very specific to production techniques, such as steel production, for example. I mean, we know that the FÖST is already working on carbon-free steel by using renewables that are generating hydrogen and thus producing steel. There's a lot of extra renewable energy that we will need, but in general, this is the right way forward. Yeah? So three other sectors. On the one hand, the most obvious case is always the building sector, by putting more insulation, by putting PV panels on the roofs of buildings. This tends to be also, of course, this on the one hand saves heating in terms of the insulation, but also generates kilowatt hours on the roofs. The roofs are mostly not used in any other ways, so it's idle resources, really. And the cost of the PV panels have come down so much that they are now competitive. There is a business case for PV panels. For a while, there had been an economic case by accounting for all the costs within the economy, but now there's a business case. It's beautiful. Yeah? So really using the idle rooftops is a next step, in addition to saving energy in the building. And for that, insulation is still the best way forward. Making the current building stock much more climate friendly. We know how to do that. Austria is excellent in its knowledge about and very innovative in coming up with new ideas in doing this with renewable resources as well, because if you put cladding and insulation on the outside, that doesn't breathe well, but also if it's not renewable, then of course it's not so sustainable. So Austria is in an excellent situation, and it can generate additional jobs. Okay. So these are, for example, co-benefits that motivating change in the building sector will yield. Mm-hmm. So that's a low-hanging fruit, because the incentive that is required is not very strong. Yeah? So that's one. In the transport sector, I think the low-hanging fruits at the moment are in cities. For example, 90% of Viennese say that to live well in Vienna, you don't need a car. This, of course, doesn't mean that 90% of Viennese don't use cars. but to make to use sort of this understanding, this knowledge that don't really need a car, but it's too easy at the moment to drive into the city center. So I think that limiting access to city centers, where there is excellent public transportation available, but also active modes of mobility, could substitute for short trips and have the co-benefit of better health. For example, a Viennese general practitioner argued recently that from a medical point of view, it might be useful to limit all car activity within the Wiener Gürtel, because that would make people walk more, maybe cycle more or use public transport. And but especially the walking more would make them more healthy. Yeah? And it's not expensive. And it would give a different impression of public space. And that is also important. So it's not only about climate action. It's about environmental conservation as well, the ecosystems, but it is also about well-being and community building. This all is included in the thinking about sustainability. So this is in terms of the mobility. And mobility in a broader sense, of course, what's required is the true costing of transport, so that the very cheap long distance transport, which is at the moment spinning some of the hyperactivity of globalization for products that are produced in an unsustainable way in another place, far away, and at the same time transported long distances, that needs to change. We can't have that in the current mode. And also international shipping and international aviation needs to become part of the carbon accounting, because at the moment climate gas accounting is inaccurate in that regard, because often it's excluded because it's not accounted for any one particular country.
Thank you very much for this very good insights on the low-hanging fruits that we actually could also tackle on our own by, for example, not buying a car and use very many different opportunities of transportation, modes of transportation that we actually have in Vienna. So you already mentioned that the German court, the highest court, decided on that the climate law is not sufficient or not sufficiently supporting the younger generations in the combating climate change. And last year, at the beginning of the pandemic, you signed a letter to the Austrian government, which was then a very new government as well, together with NGOs and other researchers, where you proposed a certain set of measures to the Austrian government. So you also very actively participated in, so to say, influencing or informing the government with your proposals. What was, in your personal opinion, the most striking policy recommendation that you made? And is there any that was already put in place? Or do you see something happening there?
I think the first one has to be to get the prices right. And this is not because I think this is enough or that this is not without problems. But it's like a hygiene factor. When living in a market economy and even maybe a market society, meaning where markets do play an important role in allocating resources, but also in allocating awards and so on. And if the prices systematically sent the wrong messages, of course, we have a problem, because systematically people make wrong decisions from an economic point of view, not from an individual point of view, not from a company perspective, but from an economic point of view. Systematically, we get the wrong decisions. Yeah. And that has repercussions. That has repercussions on the environment, on ecosystems, and on other people. And that is problematic. Yeah. And this is nothing revolutionary at all. This is economics 101. Yeah. So do that first. I think we are on a good path now. Also, carbon prices have gone up. They've doubled within the last few months, which is a good first step, but it needs to move up much longer, at the much further. And also to include, of course, all sectors that, for example, in Austria are not included yet. Yeah. So there are national as well as European level processes in place. Also, Angela Merkel, interestingly, recently came out saying that, well, maybe we should not just maybe, we should have a global carbon price. Because at the moment, it's more than 3/4 of greenhouse gases that are emitted are not under any pricing regime, which is really problematic. This is a bad, is an economic bad that should be taxed, of course, or be put under any other of the regulatory regimes that we know, and it's not done. So this is sort of a first step. Of course, it can have regressive effects, and we need to counter them. Yeah, because poorer households are known to spend a larger share of their household income on energy services, at least for heating, not so much on transport, because the poorer households don't own cars normally, except in the rural areas. So we need to make sure that what is put in place doesn't increase social inequality. Yeah, but that's a matter for economists to calibrate the instruments, but still get the prices right. Yeah, that's the first step. But that is not enough. Okay. What next needs to be done is to put infrastructures in place that allow for public transport to be made widely available. This is probably the most prominent measure that the current environment minister, Leonore Gewessler, has put in place, the 1-2-3 ticket, which is good and right. Of course, we need much more expansion of public offers in all areas, also in rural areas, so that people can really use the ticket. But that's the right way to go. Absolutely. Yeah. So that everybody has a subscription of public transport. And basically, whenever they think, whenever they want to, they can hop on public transport. That changes the logic in the decision making. Do I use public transport, which I've paid already the subscription for the year? Or do I go extra with the car, meaning encountering extra cost? That changes the logic of decision making. And that is what we need. Yeah. But as I said earlier, it's not just about physical infrastructure and carbon prices. It is also about an awareness of the possibilities of innovation, as well as new practices that may be good for us. Yeah? We started out with satisfying human needs, and human needs are better satisfied in more equal societies. That is an empirical fact. They are better satisfied in an environment where there are public spaces that can be used. They're better satisfied in areas where children have access to good childcare, good schools, health facilities available, and so on. Yeah? So I think we need to come away from thinking all about economic production, but rather about social provisioning systems, which are aligned with human needs, and how to make them available in the most cost-effective way, of course, but make them available for all, and in a way that we are reducing emissions and biophysical impacts. So this is what we basically need, and there are many measures that need to be implemented. They need to be coordinated with each other in the sense of the integrated policies. It's still a long way to go, but the positive message is, if done well, we can increase human well-being and reduce social inequality on the way. This is why we're talking about a socio-ecological transformation much more than individual policy measures in our academic work.
Yeah, very interesting. And thank you for those insights. One question that popped into my head. So we are now obviously living uncertain times because of the corona situation. I mean, we can already perceive that there is a possible end coming from the health perspective because of the vaccinations that are already here. But for the economy, from an economic perspective, would you say that actually this would be a very good moment to sort of use the restart button of the economic system and really start to rethink and maybe, yeah, start to go towards a transformation, socio-ecological transformation?
Yeah, it's not just a good opportunity. I mean, on the one hand, yes, let's hope that the vaccines are delivering, as it seems at the moment, great protection for those who are immunized, and soon, at least in the rich countries, the largest part of the populations will be immunized. It's still a big challenge for poor countries. Hopefully, it will be tackled in the next few months. I think it's a humanitarian crisis, but it's a difficult situation, absolutely. Uncertainty, you mentioned, yes, decision-making under uncertainty. I've realized it's much easier to write about decision-making uncertainty than to live in a situation where uncertainty is so high. So, of course, we're all struggling with that. In economic terms, I think it's not just a good opportunity, but it's absolutely necessary, and it's legally required, and also necessary from an economic point of view to really instigate the socio-ecological transformation now. Because, well, governments around the world have signed the Paris Agreement, they've signed the SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals of the United Nations, they have signed up for the European Green Deal or the US version of the new Green Deal, and so on. So there are plans, there are strategies, there are policies that have been announced in part. They have been put into law already. So it's absolutely necessary to have a more needs-based, social provision-oriented economy that acknowledges biophysical boundaries. The rhetoric is there. The intentions are there. What I'm concerned about is that too many of the measures are still geared up to maximize economic production. And don't get me wrong, I have nothing against economic production, of course, that provides for our goods and services that we enjoy and need. But the problem is that until we have very stringent environmental and climate regulation, this economic production is still going to produce a lot of material use and need a lot of material and produce a lot of climate gases. And I'm worried about this acceleration that will happen in the next few months, not because it allows people to go back to their jobs and secure their livelihoods. Of course, that's what I'm happy about. But we haven't seen the necessary structural changes yet. The signs are mixed. The messages that we get from the policy circles are very mixed. Yeah. On the one hand, big intentions, yet the specific plans are still small, and too much of the economy is sort of going towards a direction of let's go back to normal, what we had before. But it had already been said that business as usual was not an option. Yeah, and of course, on the one hand, it's a good opportunity, a crisis, to use a crisis where lots of things are in motion, are changing already, to motivate change. On the other hand, of course, a lot of businesses have used up their credit lines, they have used up their savings and so on. So they are stretched. Yet, in several sectors, for example, in the restaurant sector, hospitality sector, we see some of the most innovative restaurants, for example, they've used the time to change over. For example, to become a vegan restaurant, because that is one area where there are low-hanging fruits to reduce emissions and land use by moving from meat-oriented diets and provisioning to plant-based diets. Yeah? And I've seen a lot of announcements from restaurants when we're reopening, we will become vegan restaurants, for example. And this is not an easy change because cooks are trained in one particular way of cooking and they pride themselves. And often in the Austrian cuisine, still the meat is sort of the centerpiece and the rest of it is garnish and decoration useful. But that's not what they're proud of. Yeah, so it's much more than just a product that the cooks are offering. It's also what their identity is. And that also needs to change. And all within a rather short period of time, minus 55% of emissions in 8.5 years and completely decarbonizing within 18.5 years. It's a stiff challenge in front of us, but I think everyone can contribute. And we're seeing a lot of levers that are already being moved. I think it's just we need to gear up, speed up a bit more and really acknowledge that everyone needs to think through how can I reduce my 55% of emissions in the next 8.5 years.
I would give the question back to you. What are you planning on doing to reduce your 55% in the next 8.5 years?
It's, of course, the more you've tried in the past, the more difficult that is, really. So I live in a house that is super well insulated. We have PV panels on our roof. So we're lucky that that was possible for us in economic terms. So for accounting purposes, the house is carbon neutral, not in November, but over across the year. Yeah. So this will be difficult. I was born vegetarian, which is a strike of luck. I grew up on a farm and I always had a battle with my family that I didn't want to eat the meat on Sunday. So that was easy for me as well. I love cheese though. So that is an area where I need to improve. I have cut out on the milk and in coffee recently. It tastes different, but it's something different, but it's good. My coffee consumption is the next one that is a low-hanging fruit, and to have that, I think, would be, it's definitely something I need to do. I didn't drink any coffee during pregnancy when I was breastfeeding my daughter, so I know it's possible, but in the daily routine, sometimes that goes under. And the next thing is, of course, transport. Well, I do cycle in Vienna, so that is straightforward. But as an academic, sometimes I do have the impression that I need to be somewhere where giving presentations, being part of an academic community, and to be still more stringent with myself of not doing international travel by airplane. 3 years ago, I traveled to a conference in Mexico. In hindsight, I probably wouldn't do that anymore because I didn't have time to stay, or it was just for 3 days, really, really squeezed into my busy schedule, 10,000 kilometers. I mean, this is ridiculous for a three-day event. On the other hand, it is an international community. Hopefully now we'll do many more events, meetings, engagements via video conferencing. So this is a big lever that I hope in my area, in my work area, that ideas can travel, but the bodies of academics don't have to travel, at least through the air anymore. But when we can do it on the ground, for example, we can have local hubs for international conferences, we can still exchange and meet others, and but longer distance, we probably need to exchange virtually rather than physically. So these are sort of my plans. Oh, and my cat eats meat. I'm still struggling with that. On the one hand, animal rights, but at the same time, this is surely a contribution that my household is making to the greenhouse gas emissions.
Thank you. That's very interesting. Even though I know that it's very hard to actually change cat food because they are not very good at being vegetarians. So that's a difficult one, I would say. But yeah.
And also I know what he does when he gets food that he doesn't like. Goes out and gets his own food. We may not want that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this is a hard nut to crack. I don't have an answer yet.
What would you say would be, from a also macroeconomic perspective, maybe the role of social entrepreneurship or social businesses to a kind of social ecological transformation? And what maybe should new social entrepreneurs have in mind when they have their innovative idea?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think they're already making a great contribution by having the social dimension upfront in their considerations. So this is really important for community development and allowing people to secure their livelihoods, but in a way that is conducive to the development of not just the economy, but also society. The obvious point is to have the environmental dimension on the radar as well. It's not that we can afford to leave that out for the sake of accounting for the social dimension. For example, the older idea of qualitative growth was that, well, we are just growing those sectors that are less material intense, less environmentally harmful, and not growing the brown sectors, but rather just the green sectors. Yeah. There are two problems with that. On the one hand, we need still the products that are currently produced in the brown sector, so we need to make all of them green, really. Otherwise, they may be just relocated. That doesn't help because global emissions are mixing. It doesn't matter where they are rising. Then also the share of the brown sectors is not so big in the total economic production as we might think. Yeah? And services are not as green as we might think. So if we think about care provision for an elderly person, my mother lives in the rural area in a village, and there are carers stopping by throughout the day to make sure that she takes her medicine on time and the food is delivered and so on, which is all good and well. Of course, it allows me to have a full-time job and my sister as well. But at the same time, there are a lot of trips involved. There are a lot of materials involved. When I spent a few weeks there at the start when setting it up, I saw all the materials that are required. But we need to become better in that. So also what is seen as social entrepreneurship, which of course I welcome wholeheartedly, but needs to get better in terms of its environmental impact. I think that's the obvious part from my side. But I think we can still have cross-fertilization, because what social entrepreneurs are already doing well is to develop novel business models. And to experiment and find out under different conditions what might work and so on. And from this experimentation, also environmental entrepreneurs might learn and then hopefully have some cross-fertilization so that we have socio-ecological entrepreneurs.
That sounds like a very good outlook to the future. So I think our time is almost up. So my very last question would be, what was the book you most recently read and would recommend our listeners?
It's about climate policy by Noam Chomsky and Rob Paulin. It's an unusual pairing up of a macroeconomist and Noam Chomsky, of course. It's fantastic. I would recommend that. I'm almost through it.
Okay. That's a good recommendation also for me personally. And yeah, with this book recommendation and last question, I would like to thank you for being here with us and for this very many great insights into what we personally can do, but also what policymakers and from a broader economic perspective needs to be changed. And thank you for being here. Have a nice week and a nice day.
Thanks for the invitation. Maybe as a last message about sustainable behaviors, don't beat yourself up in your own area, but rather get involved, go out, engage with others and find better ways of doing something, whatever you're doing, more sustainably. That's more fun and it tends to be more effective. Thanks for the invitation. All the best for the future podcasts.
Thank you.
Once again, thank you to Professor Sigrid Stagel. As she mentioned, sustainability is a complex topic and is embedded in questions of justice.
In addition, she argues sustainable development is only possible when the product's prices are adapted to their impact on people and the planet. This means calculating externalities and effects on the planet into the price of a product would be a large step in direction of a more sustainable future.
In our next episode, we welcome two guests that can introduce us to the perspectives and opinions on sustainability from a business perspective. One of the two guests is Alparslan Delilolo, CEO and CSO of IKEA Austria. What that actually means, CSO, is something you can hear in the episode next to IKEA's take on sustainability and their new project at Wien Westbahnhof. Our second guest is Richard Auer-Wilsbach, an organic farmer with a vision towards sustainable agriculture. Together, both will discuss similarities and differences in their approach towards sustainability.
And inspired by Sigrid Stagel's own reflection on unsustainable habits, we want to encourage you to discuss your ideas to reduce your ecological footprint, be it on our Instagram channel, insideimpact_, or via email to insideimpact@wu.ac.at. And as always, if you like Inside Impact, feel free to give us a review on your favorite podcast platform and also tell your friends about it. See you next week, or better, hear you next week actually, and all the best from us here at the Inside Impact team.
Take care.